Save faster, borrow smarter, move sooner with CME. Earn 6.5% APY with an Ohio Homebuyer Plus savings account. And when you're ready to buy, enjoy a low 5.1 ARM mortgage rate. Plus, CME pays $750 toward closing costs. Start your path to homeownership today with CME Federal Credit Union. Subject to membership eligibility and approval, APY means annual percentage yield, APR means annual percentage rate. Terms apply. Federally insured by NCUA, Equal Housing Lender. Visit CMEFCU.org for details.
Hi, I'm David Haynes. Welcome to On Politics at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Well, we have a lot to talk about this week. I'll be joined today by Craig Gilbert of our Washington Bureau, Tom Kircher, Don Bain, Dan Bice, and Mary Spicuzza in Milwaukee. Let's get to the headlines first. Donald Trump takes on both Hillary Clinton and the GOP. There's a new Marquette University Law School poll that takes the temperature of the races. We'll talk about that. The race for U.S. Senate appears to be tightening. We'll fact-check the Senate candidates. There's a possibility of a new tax for Milwaukee County. We'll talk about that with Don Baim. We'll have winners and losers and your questions. But first, let's go to Craig Gilbert in Washington. I spoke with Craig just a few moments ago. Well, Craig, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Good to be with you.
So, extraordinary event this week. First, the tape that we've all talked about for almost a week now, showing Donald Trump and Billy Bush, that we don't have to say any more about. But then Paul Ryan, in a call to the Congressional Caucus, his caucus, says that he can no longer defend or campaign for Donald Trump. What was Paul Ryan's calculus there, his political calculus?
Well, you know, Paul Ryan has been trying to kind of thread the needle on Donald Trump all along. If you remember, he announced back in May that he wasn't sure he could endorse Donald Trump. He had to think about it. He finally endorsed him, but he's also criticized him. And so, in a sense, you know, this was consistent with his past position. He's continues to endorse him. He hasn't unendorsed him. But this was a pretty strong signal to be sending to say you're no longer going to defend him. You're not going to appear with him. He disinvited him from the Wisconsin event that was held last week. So, you know, the risk, I mean, the upside to that strategy has been that if you look at his popularity in the state of Wisconsin, which is significant, he's drawing that both from pro-Trump and anti-Trump voters in Wisconsin, not just pro-Trump Republicans, but anti-Trump Republicans like Paul Ryan. And he's even getting some support from anti-Trump independents and probably more support from Democrats who are very anti-Trump than other Republicans. The risk is whether that collapses on both sides. If the anti-Trump people are mad at you because they think you're abandoning their candidate, and the pro-Trump, I mean, are mad at you because you've endorsed Trump, and the pro-Trump people are mad at you because they think you're abandoning your candidate, then you end up losing from both sides.
Yeah, well, that was my question. My next question was, this was ostensibly to campaign for congressional candidates and protect their majority, but is there a chance, as you're saying, that that could backfire?
Yeah, I mean, there's even a debate. I mean, Paul Ryan has always kind of framed his criticism of Donald Trump in terms of principle and ideology and philosophy and values. And he's tended to frame his support for Donald Trump in terms of political calculus, which is that I'm the speaker. I can't afford to divide my party. I also have to represent my members, many of whom represent districts that are very pro-Trump. But there's a debate just on in terms of sheer political calculus over what the best way for Republicans and House Republicans and Senate Republicans is to handle this. Some people think the best way is to stick behind Trump to keep the party unified and not depress Republican turnout. And other people think it's everybody for themselves. So Republicans, in order to reach out and appeal to independents who don't like Trump and moderates who don't like Trump, they should be free to distance themselves and abandon him. It's just a very tough line to walk. Paul Ryan's been trying to walk that, but some of the second guessing you hear from other Republicans is maybe he just should have kept quiet and not attracted attention, and you wouldn't have had this kind of civil war with Trump coming back and attacking Ryan on Twitter for several days now.
Yeah, turnout is important, right? And now Trump's calculus seems to have changed. There's some arguing that essentially what Trump is doing with a no-holds-barred kind of campaign going forward is to depress Democratic turnout.
Yeah, and that seems like a really kind of a several bank shots from succeeding in my eyes, because you could just as easily argue that by pursuing that strategy, he's mobilizing Democrats rather than demoralizing them. I mean, it's Trump is his presidential prospects are very dire at the moment with this unfolding scandal, all the allegations, possibly more shoes to drop. And he's just at a severe disadvantage right now in the battleground states, in states like Wisconsin. And we can talk about that, where his path, his map, his path to victory nationally is very thin. And his prospects in some of these battleground states are kind of dire right now.
Let's talk about the Marquette poll, which came out on Wednesday. And it shows Hillary Clinton with a wider lead. But talk a bit about how that poll is conducted and the differences in how people responded depending on when they were asked the question.
Yeah, so about half the people in the poll were surveyed before the news of the Trump tape came out, and about half were surveyed as the story was breaking or right after in the days immediately following the story breaking. So it was a great kind of test of the impact of this, and essentially the two candidates were tied among the voters who were surveyed before the tape came out. As it was coming out, she opens up a single-digit lead. But in the aftermath of the story, as it's being widely kind of digested and reported, she opens up a 19-point lead. So there's a huge swing over the course of this poll. It makes it hard to know exactly where the race stands, but there's some real consistencies in the fundamentals of this race. If you look at the polling overall, I mean, he's still in the high, hasn't been able to break out of the high 30s in terms of his overall support in a four-way race, which is daunting. His favorabilities among independents and women and college-educated voters are all in the high 20s, and they've been stuck there for several months. And he's still only getting 80% or less of the Republican vote, and that's been true for several months. And he needs a bigger figure than that to win. Hillary Clinton's getting 90% of the Democratic vote.
Right, and past Republican candidates, Mitt Romney, for example, got in the mid-90s, right, or low 90s.
Yeah, and you can't, it's very hard unless you're getting crossover support from the other party, which he's not, or dominating him in the independents, which he's not. You can't afford to have anything less than almost uniform, unanimous support from your own party.
All right, we'll have to leave it there. Craig Gilbert in Washington, thanks so much.
Great. Talk to you later.
And now I'm joined by Mary Spicuzza and Bill Glauber in our Milwaukee studio. And Bill, we're going to talk a bit about the U.S. Senate race. New Marquette poll out. We talked to Craig about the presidential race. What's happening with the Senate race?
This thing had been glacial for more than a year. Feingold with a comfortable lead. And this week, for the first time, it's the closest it's been. It's inside the margin of error. Feingold with, I believe, 46%. Ron Johnson with 44%. Libertarian candidate Phil Anderson with about 4%. Mm-hmm. 5% undecided. So game on. It's a race.
Yeah, were you surprised that it tightened up? I mean, here you have the top of the ticket basically imploding. But the down ticket race, in this case the Senate race, getting tighter.
Yeah, well, Johnson has basically worked his way back into the race with, you know, he went on air in September, went with some positive ads, then drove home a negative message against Russ Feingold. He's a career politician, you know, without any accomplishments. And, you know, it seems to at least have been working. He got Republicans to come back home, about 89% Republican support. Feingold with about 90% of Democratic support, but in that poll, Feingold had about a 7-point lead among independents. So, you know, Johnson was left for dead, let's face it, by the national Republicans. They may deny it, but, you know, they pulled out some ads, right. The NRSC, right. And Johnson just, you know, doggedly kept working it and, you know, is within striking distance, but there's a long way to go, and let's face it, if Donald Trump has imploded in the state and loses by hundreds of thousands of votes, that's a big if. I'm not predicting that. But, you know, with those sets of circumstances, it would be very difficult for Johnson to come through.
That's a lot of ticket splitting.
He's put himself in position, though, and I think there's little question about that.
Yeah, Mary, you've covered politics in the state for quite a while now. What do you make of this race?
You know, it's funny. It feels like it's been going on for so long, like 6 years.
No, it's only been going on a year and a half.
But it's, you know, back in 2010, I remember covering Scott Walker's race against Tom Barrett. In this case, it seems like it's the opposite, where people are so focused on the Donald Trump phenomenon and the battle with Hillary Clinton, that other than people like Russ Feingold and Ron Johnson and Bill Glauber, I still just feel like this race has been so overshadowed. And it's interesting to see that it's, you know, I was kind of surprised, honestly, that he had closed in the poll and was now, what, 2 points away?
Well, Johnson, in one of the recent polls, still wasn't that well known in the state.
Oh, no, it's always like a third of the people don't know who
did that.
But
he
drove that down. You know, about 20% of people, likely voters, said they didn't know enough about him to draw an opinion that's driven down in the current poll.
Okay.
So, and you know, Feingold's at about 15%, which is where you'd figure. So they're both now among likely voters about as well known as they're going to be. Yeah. And so now let's just see what happens.
Yeah.
More trusted than either of our presidential candidates, though. So both of them are doing better in that regard.
Yeah, they are. I mean, they are both above water right now on favorable, unfavorable, which, given the climate, is extraordinary.
So we have some debates coming up. When are those? And how important are those going to be to this?
Obviously, they're an ability to move the race. You have a debate Friday night in Green Bay. It's a one-hour debate. Wisconsin broadcasters. Very formatted, lots of people asking questions, not a lot of time to give answers to questions. It'll be, you know, a more normal kind of debate that you would see, maybe even a joint appearance. Tuesday night, they come back to Milwaukee at Marquette University Law School. That's a 90-minute debate that will be moderated by Mike Gushay. There are no rules. It's basically Mike Gushay asking questions and the candidates answering the questions. That potentially could be the more lively
situation.
More
of a chance for them to mix it up.
Even there was a debate between Chris Abley and Chris Larson that, you know, they threw some elbows. So it's interesting.
So Mary, at the presidential level, the debates are well-watched, or at least have been this election cycle for obvious reasons, but are many people going to watch the Senate debates? I mean, how much does that really matter, do you think?
I don't think it's going to be like the turnout that we've seen for the presidential, although the last presidential was at the same time as the Packers, so maybe they'll do better given that.
Well, the Friday night debate goes
that was against, a tough choice.
Friday night goes against Fish Fry in high school football, so that Friday night. But the Tuesday night debate is an 8:30 to 10 p.m. debate.
You might actually watch that one.
That has some, you know, real possibility of some significant viewership that will be broadcast statewide on radio and television. So if you don't want to get away from it, if you actually want to hear this thing or watch it, there'll be ample opportunity.
So Bill,
who would have thought that when his kids were growing up, Russ Feingold would sing to them to wake them up? It's almost hard to believe in this age of television and politics, and you don't really see the candidates up close. You know, they're really flesh and blood guys. You know, both married, both with families, both have very good stories to tell about themselves, and it's been a very competitive race, and it'll be an interesting finish.
Yeah. All right. Well, that's enough on the Senate race for right now, but we're going to move now to Tom Kircher of PolitiFact Wisconsin. And Tom has a story that's coming out in Friday's paper where he fact checks these two candidates. And we talked to Tom just a moment ago. So Tom, you've got a few PolitiFact claims that you're checking out for a story that will be in the Friday paper. We have two by Senator Ron Johnson and two by former Senator Russ Feingold. So let's start with Ron Johnson. He says that Russ Feingold broke his 1992 promise to always get the majority of funding from Wisconsin residents, and PolitiFact's rating on that is true. What's the backstory?
Yeah, that's a reference to 1992. Feingold was running for the state Senate, said he would get most of his campaign money from Wisconsinites, not from people out of state or special interests. He kept that promise until this campaign. He now takes more of his money from out of state than he does in state. And his promise back in 92 was for going forward, not strictly for that campaign. So that's why we rated Johnson's statement true.
Okay. Let's move on to the next one. This also from Ron Johnson. He says that Russ Feingold was, quote, the only senator to vote against Homeland Security. And your rating on that is false.
Right. There are actually nine senators back in 2002 who voted against creating the Department of Homeland Security, Feingold being one of the nine.
Okay. Now let's move to a couple of claims by Russ Feingold. He says that Ron Johnson, quote, helped companies ship jobs overseas, and our rating on that was not true, false.
Yeah, that's a reference to Johnson voting for three different free trade deals, including one with South Korea. We did find there's evidence that there are estimates of possible job losses in the United States as a result of those free trade deals, but we did not find any evidence to indicate that jobs were shipped overseas because of the trade deals.
So that's more of an opinion than a point of fact at this point. And then finally, says that the average student debt, this is Russ Feingold, coming out of the University of Wisconsin-Madison is something like $28,000, and our rating on that was mostly true.
Yeah, the number is correct for UW-Madison students who do borrow money. Our only qualification on this one is that about half of the UW-Madison students don't borrow at all.
All right. Tom Kircher of PolitiFact Wisconsin. Again, look for Tom's story in Friday's Journal Sentinel, where he'll be rating some additional claims by both candidates. Well, another Milwaukee politician made some news this week when he announced the possibility of a wheel tax. We spoke with County Executive Chris Abley about that earlier in the week.
Our biggest source of funding is 90 miles west of here, and we don't have, unfortunately, as much control over that as we'd like, and transit funding is less for the county now from the state than it was even in 2009, and our costs have gone up, not surprisingly. Mm-hmm. And you know, our deferred maintenance, while we have made progress, we're sort of at a tipping point. And the idea with the vehicle registration fee is, as I said to Mark and I've said to other people, you know, I don't love the idea. I don't think there's anybody who loves a new cost, you know, or something, being asked to pay more locally. But I'm more concerned with the consequences of not doing anything. I mean, and since it's the only legal option we've got, we have still some room on property tax revenue, but even if we maxed our capacity on that, it wouldn't be close. We wouldn't be able to keep up with just sustainable transit, let alone bus replacement, which is expensive.
And now I'm joined by Don Boehm. Don covers Milwaukee County for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. And Don, welcome.
Thank you.
So what have you heard so far, feedback from the supervisors on the wheel tax?
Well, the county supervisors are not swarming in support of the proposed $60 vehicle right. registration fee or wheel tax.
That would be big news if they were.
Right. The county board rejected a wheel tax in 2010. Right. This is the first time it's resurfaced since then. Supervisor Michael Mayo Sr., who was on the board at that time and is the Transportation Committee Chairman, is opposed to a county wheel tax. He believes it would hit City of Milwaukee vehicle owners the hardest because city vehicle owners already pay a $20 fee on top of the $75 state fee. Mm-hmm. So if you impose a $60 county fee on that, you're at a total of $155.
Right.
Some other supervisors, like David Sartori, have said they might be willing to accept a smaller wheel tax, say $25. But regardless of where this goes in the county budget, Board Chairman Lipscomb and others will be sure to let the public know that this all came from County Executive Abel.
That was Abel's idea, not
right.
theirs. So what might the options be here? He's proposing $60, and what does the county get if it does $60 versus, say, $30, $20?
Well, on options, the county board is in a tough place receiving this recommended executive budget. If they don't embrace the $60 wheel tax, they will have to find that revenue to fill the gap from other sources.
Or cut costs, I guess.
Or cut costs.
Another option. Yeah. Yeah.
And on other revenues, the budget is already bumping up against the state-imposed property tax levy cap for next year. And the a kind of earlier recommendation to impose a parking fee on the lakefront north of the marina, you know, was rejected after heavy public criticism. So there aren't a lot of other choices at this time, and the city can't increase its sales tax without a change in state law. Mm-hmm. So an earlier paper put out by the Abley administration and looked at different levels of wheel taxes. At $20, let me look this up, you would generate $10.8 million. Mm-hmm. So that would help offset declining state and federal support for transportation costs and services, and also help reduce county borrowing for paying for road rebuilding, bridge repairs, or replacing buses.
And this would have to be used for transportation-related expenses, correct?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
At $60, that new fee would generate $27.1 million in 2017. There'd be a little delay in implementing it. The state collects these fees. Mm-hmm. A full year would be more in the range of $31 to $33 million for the same type of transportation infrastructure, rebuilding roads, bridges, replacing buses. And this will also help the county implement the proposed bus rapid transit mm-hmm. service between downtown Milwaukee and the Regional Medical Center in Wauwatosa.
So this is all gets fairly complicated pretty quickly. Well, Don, thanks so much.
Thank you.
It's time now. I'm back with Dan Bice and Mary Spacusa. We're going to do winners and losers. Mary, let me turn to you first. Who's your winner this week?
I would say Ken Bone.
Ken Bone.
Right.
Refresh our memory.
The
Who's
now
Ken
famous
Bone?
Ken Bone. He was part of the...
What colors?
Red sweater.
Red
sweater, white hat.
Honor of Ken Bone.
Right, exactly. So he was one of the undecided voters at the second debate and asked a very earnest question about energy policy and apparently had an olive suit that split earlier in the day and had to change outfits.
I didn't hear this.
Yes. So he wore the little red zip-up from Kohl's, of course. It's unclear whether he used Kohl's cash to purchase it like Governor Walker, but another Kohl's fan. And he seemed to have won over the internet, and people like I think someone
the
said
the only he, person to come out smelling okay out of that first debate.
Second,
what a thing!
Yeah, yeah, he I think somebody tweeted that he was the human equivalent of a hug, and that.
Right.
So he won lots of fans.
But his question was self-interested.
It was. He works for a coal plant in Illinois, right?
Right. Right.
So. But a coal shopper, and people were just, he was very kind of warm and fuzzy, and people loved him, and he got to do some late-night talk shows, and now his Twitter followers have expanded from, 17 to thousands. Right. So it could be 15 minutes of fame, but it's good enough to be a winner this week.
Well, good for Ken Bone. So who's the loser?
So I would say that the loser would probably be Donald Trump. It's obviously not been a good stretch for him, and it seems like every day or maybe every hour there's a new allegation against him. So in the wake of the tapes, he had the debate performance, which a lot of people felt was bullying, and bringing out the Clinton accusers is kind of bringing things further down into the gutter of this presidential campaign. But then this week, last night, there was the New York Times story that broke of women saying that he groped them. There was then the People story that came out about the former People reporter.
Buzzfeed.
There's
Arizona
now some
Republic.
Yeah. So it's basically, I feel like I'm probably missing something because it's broken in the last half hour. So.
And all of this stuff from WikiLeaks about Hillary Clinton and her staff, which would have grabbed headlines otherwise, has been just not getting much oxygen.
pushed.
Yeah. And I've read, read some of them, and they're certainly interesting, and they raise questions about conflict of interest and friends of Bill getting special attention,
right. Yeah.
Chelsea Clinton pointing out problems, but at the same time, it's just really been drowned out by the Trump allegations, and normally this could have been a great week for him, and it's just...
I am sort of waiting for the post-debate polls to come out, because all we have right now are stuff that came out after the allegations, but before the debate. I probably didn't help him tremendously much, but I'm still interested to see if there was any impact there.
Any bounce back. So, Dan, who's your loser?
On the same theme, it's I have Billy Bush for not just for participating in this, you know, back and forth in 2005, but the fact that it turns out now that he was bragging about it and talking it up to other people at the Olympics, and apparently this might have been one of the ways that came out. There have been multiple stories about how the video came out, but. But that's why he's my loser for the week.
Okay. And who's your winner?
It has to be Ron Johnson. You guys talked about Ron Johnson earlier, and we've counted him out multiple times, but he's got himself back in the game. And, you know, to be within the margin of error 20-some days before the election is something I'm sure he would have welcomed if you had told him that he could have that at the beginning of the race.
Yeah, we talked about this a bit earlier, but what's your take on why he's made a comeback?
If it's anything, I think the advertising strategies, I think that he's decided to, he's gone on two tracks. One, positive ads about him, but then these hypocrisy pieces that he's been hitting Feingold with, and there's not been any pushback on those so far as I can tell yet. I expect that they will, but, you know, it was almost as if the Feingold campaign had gone into cruise control a couple weeks ago, and I think, if anything, that has been the reason that the race has tightened.
And it was especially surprising, I think, because of the polling collapse that we saw in the Marquette poll with Donald Trump versus Ron Johnson closing the gap. It was, you know, a lot of the time you think there's going to be a downtick.
Yeah, he's certainly outperforming Trump at the moment. And there's been, I mean, back and forth on that. So I don't think this is where it settles out on. But it's you know, it's a good position for him to be in at this point.
Yeah, all right. So we have time for one question. I'm going to shoot it to you, Mary.
Okay.
One of our readers, listeners, wants to know, so how much did Donald Trump pay the GOP Oppo research team not to research him?
Oh.
Because apparently he didn't know all this. Or they didn't know all this.
Right. So I think there was a lot of opposition research done against him, probably in the primaries. I think a lot of this women are coming forward for the first time. But there was just this story that I was just reading right before we sat down about how he talked his own aides out of doing self-opposition research where people tried to prepare what might come out about them. Sure, yes, you want to know what people are going to dredge up about you so you're prepared and can respond to it and also can find out what's out there and what people are saying. And when you squash that, and I guess maybe you just think you're the greatest candidate and who could ever say anything bad about you?
You don't want to know. The funny thing was, I talked to some of the opposition research teams with several of the Republican presidential candidates. Their focus did not seem throughout much of the primary on Trump. It was on each other. And in a sense, it became a circular firing squad because everybody had information. And, you know, the thing is, it's easier to do research on Scott Walker because he's been in office his whole life. You can see what he's voted for and stuff. With Donald Trump, it's a little bit tougher to find, you know, a Miss Arizona from 1997. And many of these cases, these individuals are coming forward on their own. It's not through any, and I think the two women who were in the New York Times story, again, they reached out to the New York Times.
After the debate.
Yeah. Right, so after the debate.
Yeah. So like Monday. A new career for Billy Bush here.
Maybe.
You can run the free world. You can't just be on the Today Show.
That's right. Well, we'll have to leave it there. Thanks for joining us for this edition of On Politics. Thanks to Craig Gilbert, Tom Kircher, Don Boehm, Dan Bice, and Mary Spacuzza.
Bill.
Have a good afternoon. And Bill Glauber.